into this narrative. I want you to make this story about these wise men, I want this to be your story. And my job this morning is to really help you find your story in the story of these wise men. And I want us to see four things, and you'll find this in your bulletin. I want us to see how Jesus welcomes unlikely people in uncommon times through unconventional means and with unbelievable results. So first, Jesus welcomes unlikely people. All right, so if these men aren't kings, as the carol suggests, then who are they? Well, this may surprise you, but more than likely, these men were astrologers. Now, this is not to be confused with astronomers, which would be a legitimate science. No, this is astrologers, like the weird stuff of horoscopes, interpreting dreams, fortune telling. If you're old enough to remember, this is people like Dionne Warwick in the Psychic Friends Network, if you remember them. You see, in ancient Persia, there was, in fact, a priestly caste, and they were called magi. And these magi, they were very interested in religion and in supernatural things, but their real field of expertise and interest was they loved to study stars and their influence on human events. And so modern day astrology actually traces its roots all the way back to these Persian magi. Now, one of the objections that's raised with this theory is, all right, if these guys are from Persia, then how would they know to ask King Herod, as we're told in the text, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Because if you know your history, at the time of Jesus' birth, Judaism was not a worldwide religion. It was a religion relegated to one small people group known as Israel. So how would Persians from the area in present-day Iran know anything about a king born king of the Jews? All right, well, if you know your Jewish history, you know that back in the 6th century B.C., Jerusalem was invaded by a bunch of foreign empires, and many Jewish people were exiled into a lot of foreign lands. One of those lands was occupied by none other than the Persian Empire. And so this time period would have allowed ample opportunity for Persians to become familiar with Judaism and with many of the Jewish messianic prophecies in the Old Testament. And so while clinging to their pagan superstitions, it's quite reasonable that there were a group of Persians who had latched on to the hope of a future king coming from this small country known as Israel, and that just maybe this king coming from Israel, that he could actually be a king for all people, even for Persian astrologers. You know, it's somewhat shocking that Matthew is the one gospel writer who includes the appearance of the wise men in the story of Jesus' birth. And the reason why is because Matthew was the gospel account that was written specifically for the benefit of Jews. That was his main purpose. And yet, the message implied here in their inclusion is that the king of the Jews came and welcomed non-Jews into his kingdom. It's a pretty radical concept. But let's go further. You know, in the ancient world, the religious group that most clearly disassociated itself from like pagan religions, superstitions, magical arts would have been the Christian church. It historically took an incredibly hard line, a very principled stance against many of these pagan practices. And for this reason, it's even more odd that Matthew would even mention their appearance in his gospel account. And what's even more remarkable is that he includes them without a single negative statement about their background. He gives no such denunciation of their past or their present. You know, who would have predicted that the founders of the Psychic Friends Network were really among the witnesses that are in your manger scenes. You know, the simple fact that these men were part of the welcome into this world of Jesus, it stands as a reminder that Jesus's welcome wagon looks a lot more like the Island of Misfit Toys. It also says this, that if there's anybody here who feels like they are an outsider whenever they are around religious people, or maybe historically you felt like you are an outsider in the context of the church, understand that one of the points here is that you fit in Jesus's kingdom way more than you may have initially realized. Because Jesus came for outsiders. You know, second, Jesus welcomes in uncommon times. You know, the Apostle Paul in Galatians 4, he talks about the timing of Jesus's entrance into this world, and he speaks of it in this way. He says, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law. Well, Matthew is the one gospel writer who describes what the fullness of time looked like when Jesus first came into this world. It was during the days of King Herod. Now, King Herod was unique in that he was one of the few kings who had no royal lineage. Now, Herod's father had worked for the Roman government, but in those days, the most important trait of a king is a trait that was given to him. It was being of royal ancestry. And Herod, in ancient history, was one of the few kings who didn't have that. He had no royal blood. And so what this means is that when Herod ruled, he ruled with a huge chip on his shoulder. And when these magi showed up one day and they asked King Herod, where is he who was born king of the Jews? That very phrase would have touched a very deep and sensitive nerve within him. He would have felt very threatened by anyone who had royal blood in him, who was born a king. So threatened, in fact, that he would be willing to use deception and murder in order to deal with that threat. In verse 3, it says, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. And in fact, we learned that he employed these magi as mercenaries, or at least that was intention, to go on his behalf, to go find this child who had been born king of the Jews, and then to bring word so that he said, so that I too may come and worship him. Now, as we find out, when Herod said, so that I may worship him, he actually meant to kill him. Now, you may have also noticed in verse 3, that Herod was not the only person who was troubled by the news of the one who was born king of the Jews. But the text tells us that all of Israel, or all of Jerusalem, was troubled with him. Why would Jerusalem be troubled at the thought of the long-awaited Messiah having come into this world? Wouldn't they be rejoicing at that news, especially in the context of a volatile king like Herod? Well, I think the reason why is because at this point in Israel's history, they had given up complete hope that the Messiah would ever come. And so when they heard that Herod was aware that there was one who was born king of the Jews, what this meant for them is that Nero, or that Herod, would be coming around town, basically saying the beatings will continue until morale improves. You know, at this point, a lot of ancient literature has confirmed that Herod was actually a ruthless king. He was incredibly violent, and towards the end of his reign, which is where he was at the time of Jesus' birth, He had actually become a raving lunatic. He was basically the Kim Jong-un of the ancient world. He had killed numerous people simply because he was suspicious that they might possibly overthrow him. You know, there's other ancient literature that confirmed that Herod actually killed his three eldest sons simply because he thought they might be trying to overthrow him eventually. He killed one of his wives, and there's no reason given for why that happened. And so Jerusalem knew that this news would cause Herod to completely freak out and probably take it out on them. Now, as we find out later in chapter 2, their fears are incredibly legitimate because he decides to execute an order that all male children under the age of 2 in the town of Bethlehem are to be killed. Now, some people have said, well, that sounds like really severe. Like, could that historically have really happened? That sounds like a lot of people. Well, just to give you a little bit of perspective, at the time, Bethlehem was a village of about 1,000 people. And so most historians would guess that this would mean the death of probably about 20 boys if this order was indeed executed. And based on what I've already told you and based on the other historical evidence, this infanticide Bethlehem wouldn't have even been one of his worst atrocities as a king. But here's the point. If you really buy in to the teaching of Christianity that this was a rescue mission and that God chose the actual time and place that he would enter into this world, God welcomes in uncommon times. Jesus comes into our lives when we would least expect. You know, when the world looks really bad, and I can be a person who can do this as well, we start to suggest that when the world is really bad, that's clearly a sign that God has forsaken us. But that betrays the consistent message and testimony of Scripture. The worse things get, the greater the confidence should be that Jesus could actually be up to something in your and I's life. That Jesus' best work in our lives are in the very moments when our fingers are on the eject button when it comes with our faith in God. And so if Jesus is willing to enter into the world through the most vulnerable context imaginable as a human child, and in the context of one of the most fragile and volatile kingdoms in the ancient world, do not think that he will not show up in your life in similarly uncommon times. Third, Jesus welcomes through unconventional means. So the element of the story that's probably historically invited the most skepticism is undoubtedly the star that the wise men had followed. And so when they came to Jerusalem, here's what they told the king. For we saw his star when it rose, and I've come to worship him. And then when they came to the town of Bethlehem, Matthew tells us, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. There's been quite a bit of astronomical research into what could have caused this star to make it a reality. And some have argued that the star, that it could have been Halley's Comet. There's actually some ancient literature around that time to suggest that Halley's Comet actually appeared in the sky somewhere close to the vicinity of Jesus's birth. Others have suggested it could have been a nova or a planetary conjunction. Don't ask me what either of those are. I have no clue. But here's the thing we've got to remember. The Christian worldview hinges on the belief that God supernaturally entered into the natural world via a virgin birth, and then as an adult, he would eventually rise from the dead. So we need to be okay as Christians with acknowledging the likelihood that whatever this star is, we don't need an astronomical evidence to support how this could have happened, because our entire religion is based on the reality of the supernatural intersecting with the natural world. Here is the most important question, I think, as it relates to the star. Of all the ways that God could have drawn these Persian magi into the story of Jesus' birth, why a star of all things? I don't think there's another instance where a star has been involved with God's appearance to people. So why a star? Well, remember how I told you that the Persian priests had a fascination with stars. You know, there's a prophecy back in the book of Numbers. This is written probably over 1,000 years prior to the birth of Christ. In Numbers 24:17. And here's what the prophecy says. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. Now, if these men were in fact Persians who have a deep love of the stars, and they also happen to have interacted with a Jewish exiled community such that they would have read prophecies such as this, you got to believe that their ears would have perked up right at the moment of reading Numbers 24:17, when it speaks of a king who would come, a scepter who would rise, and a star that would come in connection with this king. Do you see what's going on here? If it's true that this passage is not as much about how these men welcome Jesus into their world, but it's really about how the God of the universe drew these men into his world, there would have been no better way to draw these men into the presence of Jesus than precisely by using their own pagan religion to do so. It's an incredibly unorthodox and unconventional method, but if you were God, this is brilliant. You know, what I think this suggests to me is that the God of the universe is incredibly unconventional when it comes to drawing people into a life-giving relationship with him. He will even use a people's pagan religion to supernaturally draw them into the presence of their Lord and Savior. I started making this connection with parenting. You know, one of the things I've found is that we, especially as American Christians, when it comes to parenting, we thrive on social convention. Like, were we to write the story of our kids' lives and what they would look like, I am confident that every one of us would make sure that no pain or suffering or prodigal moments would ever come into our kids' lives. The prayers of most Christian parents, including my own prayers for my kids, they are probably some of the most boring prayers you could imagine, because we don't want anything bad circumstantially to happen to our kids. We want everything to go great for them. But if you were to look at how God moves into our lives and into the lives of our loved ones, he has this pattern of defying social convention to bring people into his presence. He uses all the above circumstances that we as parents dread to have happen with our kids. He uses pain and suffering and prodigal moments. Now, this doesn't mean that I decided to buy my kids a Ouija board for Christmas so that I could figure out how God could kind of introduce himself to them. But it also doesn't mean that when our lives or the lives of our kids do not look the way we would have thought or hoped or dreamed, that somehow God is flustered and he's having to move to a plan B. You know, the Bible doesn't give us any reason to pray for our kids to have socially conventional lives. That's not how the God of the Bible is worked. The people shaped by the gospel are often the people who operate outside of the realm of social convention. God comes in uncommon times through unconventional means. Finally, God welcomes us with unbelievable results. You know, even though God likely played into the very superstitious beliefs of these magi in getting them into the presence of Jesus, what took place when they found themselves in the presence of Jesus, that's what's truly remarkable here in this passage. You know, if you look at verse 11, here's what Matthew tells us. Going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. You know, I believe that when these wise men originally came to Jesus to find him, that they came with the intention that they would have had for any other earthly king. They would want to pay homage to him. But in the presence of Jesus, I think something else happened. You know, upon seeing Jesus, the text says they fell down and worshiped him. You know, among historians, there's been a lot of discussion around the significance of the gifts that these magi gave, the gold, frankincense, myrrh. But here's what we do know, is in the ancient world, when a person gives a gift, it is symbolic of the receiver's superiority over the giver. And so the very act of offering a gift to Jesus, it speaks of an act of submission of these non-Jews to a baby who supposedly was born king of the Jews. You know, it's also interesting that they gave gold, frankincense, and myrrh. There's been a lot of discussion around that. But what Matthew tells us is they were not initially gifts. They were initially treasures. And then they became gifts. Now, some historians have actually pondered that if these men were indeed Persian astrologers or magicians of some sort, that it's very likely that these items were actually instruments of their trade, that they were essential to the performance of their superstitious beliefs. And if that's the case, that these items were essential to their performance as astrologers or magicians of some sort, then there's something more going on here than meets the eye. If you're an avid follower of the Peanuts comic strip and cartoons, you know the character known as Linus. And Linus is the character who's never parted from his security blanket. He took this blanket with him wherever he went. But there's one exception that has taken place in the Peanuts comic strip, and it actually takes place in the movie A Charlie Brown Christmas. Now, if you've seen the Charlie Brown Christmas movie, throughout the movie, Charlie is in search of the true meaning of Christmas, and it has only led to frustration from him. And so by the end of the movie, he finally gets to this point of desperation where he yells out, "Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?" And then out of nowhere, Linus stands up and he responds. And he says, "I can tell you what Christmas is all about, Charlie." And then he steps up onto a stage and then he recites these very words. He says, "And the angel said to them, 'Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord. And this will be a sign for you. You will find a baby wrapped in swaddling cloths and lying in a manger.'" And if you're watching a cartoon, it's really easy to miss at this moment. But if you look really closely at the moment when he is actually proclaiming the gospel, Linus drops his security blanket for the first time in its history. As he ponders the reality of God's love for him, and he begins to treasure that reality into his heart, he is able at that moment to let go of the one thing that was most precious to him, his security blanket. And it's a beautiful picture of what the gospel does for us. When someone realizes that Christmas is ultimately about God welcoming us into his world, and he does so at great cost to himself, it changes us. It causes us to let go of the very things that we previously looked to for our sense of self-worth. You know, in many ways, these wise men are meant to be juxtaposed against King Herod. You see, King Herod was so committed to his security blanket, which was his throne, that he was willing to destroy anything that got in his way. And so at the cost of his own dignity and the dignity of others, he was committed to remaining on the throne of his life. But it was people who were like the wise men, the ones who were willing to let go of the treasures of their life in order that they might have the opportunity to grab hold of the very thing that they themselves had been for their entire lives been secretly longing. And it was a joy that could only come from this man who was born King of the Jews. You know, the sacrament of